Hello, and welcome to our series of podcasts for Equine Health Week 2026 in partnership with Agria. Now, equine gastric ulcer syndrome is believed to affect around as many as one in three horses in the UK. This painful condition can be caused by multiple factors and will often have an impact on performance, temperament, and welfare. As our understanding of the condition and how it affects our horses improves, so too does how effectively we're able to treat and manage it. Plus, there are lots of simple steps that horse owners and carers can take to reduce the risk of it even developing in the first place. Joining me to discuss this all the way from Australia is a world-leading expert on this topic. Ben Sykes is a qualified veterinary surgeon and American board-certified specialist in equine internal medicine. With over 27 years of clinical experience, Ben is a world-renowned expert in equine gastric ulcer syndrome and a leading researcher and consultant. Welcome, Ben.
Thanks, Rachel. Thanks for having me. It's really exciting. Really glad you reached out and looking at the list of the topics you've had for the week, I think this just sits beautifully in between what you've been talking about and what comes next.
I know. Well, it has worked quite well, I have to say. When we put this list together, it has all woven in nicely. So yeah, hopefully people who've been following along the week can pick up some of the bits we've discussed already and we'll still then see how this all fits in and with what we're going to be discussing the rest of the week as well. So then let's dive straight in there. When we talk about equine gastric ulcer syndrome, what actually is that? Because I think our understanding of it has changed a bit in recent years, hasn't it? And sort of expanded.
Yeah, it's really important to recognize. It's a great starting point because it's really important to recognize that although we use the term equine gastric ulcer syndrome, there's not really a disease, equine gastric ulcer syndrome. Specifically, we're primarily referring to two diseases within that term. So it's sort of an umbrella term. And then we have two specific disease, main specific diseases that operate or occur underneath that umbrella. And so the one that we know the most about, the one that we've sort of traditionally called EGUS, is squamous disease. The squamous mucosa is the lining of the top half of the stomach. And basically, that's the same as your skin. So it's the same as your skin. It's the same as your esophagus. And at a very simple level, you have a tissue that doesn't like acid. And under normal management conditions, under normal sort of conditions for horses, there's very limited acid exposure of the squamous mucosa. But when we talk about management factors, which we'll get to later, various things can influence that. And if we get increased acid exposure, effectively we end up with a chemical burn. And so squamous disease really comes down to being a chemical burn because acid's splashing up from the bottom of the stomach where it's normally made and belongs up to the top of the stomach where it doesn't belong. About 10 years ago, we started to recognize a lot more about glandular disease. So the glandular mucosa is the bottom half of the horse's stomach. It's like our stomach, so it's the part of the stomach. It's much more complex. It makes acid. It's a lot more involved in things like digestion and those types of processes. It's normal for that part of the stomach to be bathed in highly acidic acid. We're talking about a pH of 1 to 2. So this is almost pure hydrochloric acid, extremely acidic environment. About 10 years ago, we really started to recognize that we were recognizing more disease there. And that was really just probably a change that our gastroscopes got longer so we could see more. And once we started seeing more, we started recognizing a lot of disease in the bottom half of the stomach. And so we call that glandular gastric disease. And really what we do now is we separate those two terms out completely. And so if we have a conversation or if you go to the vet and you get a diagnosis of gastric ulcers, the diagnosis you're actually going to get is not going to be EGUS. It's going to be your horse has squamous disease, your horse has glandular disease, or possibly your horse has both.
And with those two different ones, when we're talking about sort of the risk factors and the underlying causes, I'm assuming they're going to be slightly different because you're talking about different areas of the stomach that have a different resistance or compatibility with that acid that's in there.
Yeah, 100%. And that's why that distinction is so important, because effectively they're two entirely separate diseases. They just happen to live in the same compartment. So I think of them as that old TV show, The Odd Couple. They happen to live in the same compartment, but they really don't have much to do with each other. And so we occasionally get severe glandular disease, cause squamous disease, but in the vast majority of cases, we're actually talking about two separate processes running in parallel. And it's really important because when we talk about things like the horses that are potentially at risk, when we talk about the management factors that contribute to disease, when we talk about treatment and we talk about prevention, it's important that we've been really specific of understanding which of those two diseases we're treating or potentially both. at a very high level, I think of squamous disease as being 80% management and 20% horse. And we'll get into that a little bit, but it's really a lot of these management factors we impose on horses as part of our expectations from them that contribute to disease. Glandular disease is a much more sort of horse-centric disease. There appears to be a breed predisposition with warm bloods predisposed. And it's really more about, it's still about the horse's environment, but it's more about the horse's intersection with that environment. And so we think of it much more as a stress-based disease. And so I think of that more as being 80% horse and 20% management. So there are some management factors that are important, but it really comes down to being very much a horse-based disease, whereas squamous disease I see primarily as a management-based disease. But there is some crossover between, you know, management and individual in each case.
Okay, so talking then, you've mentioned that the management and how key that is, particularly with the squamous version of what we're talking about today. What are then some of those risk factors in how we manage our horses that might predispose them to developing the ulcers?
Yes, let's start with squamous, because as I said, it really is that management-based disease. And you know, the challenge is we can make it as complex as we want, or we can make it as simple as we want, and the truth is somewhere in the middle. So if you Google, you know, what are the risk factors for squamous disease, you can get a whole range of different things. Maybe the sex of the horse influences, maybe the age of the horse influences, but none of that I really worry about, because they're things I can't change. That's that 20% horse. I can't change that. So when I'm thinking about it as a clinician, I'm thinking about what's the 80% I can change. And the other thing is that 80% is the main driver of disease. And so when I'm thinking about what those are, I'm thinking there's three big factors. So I'm thinking about roughage. And so I'm thinking about the type of roughage, the amount of roughage, and the timing of roughage. I'm thinking about the non-structural carbohydrate load in the horse's diet, particularly the amount of non-structural carbohydrates per meal. And then I'm thinking about exercise. And specifically for squamous disease, I'm thinking about the duration of exercise, because remember we said it's a chemical burn. So the longer there's exposure, the more the burn is going to occur. And the timing of exercise. So the timing of exercise has this intersection with feeding, because it's this relationship between the horse's normal defense mechanism is roughage. And we'll probably talk more about roughage and chewing today than you ever cared. But it's so important. It's the number one thing when we talk about gastric health in horses is ensuring appropriate roughage intake. And then there's this intersection between roughage and feeding. When we talk about glandular disease, there are still management factors associated. We still see a relationship with exercise, but it's a different relationship. We see it's the number of days the horse exercises per week. Or if we look at it another way, it's the absence of rest days. And so when we see horses having less than 2 or 3 rest days per week, their risk of glandular disease dramatically increases. And so rest days appear to be really important for glandular health. And then we see behavioral interactions for the horse. So we see intersections with the number of handlers and riders. We see intersections with things like concurrent diseases like lameness and those types of things as causes of pain. And so we separate those out, and already we can see there's a very big difference when we say, yes, there's management for both of them, but they're very, very different for those two disease types.
Absolutely. And as you say, we'll get on a bit later into sort of how we can optimize that management and that horse's environment to try and to reduce the risk there. But in terms of if you're looking at your horse, what are some of the signs and symptoms you might see that suggest that they are suffering from one or other of these diseases?
Oh, it's almost a holy grail question. So historically, when we focused on squamous disease and we really looked a lot at squamous disease, particularly in racehorses, because they're kind of a developmental model for squamous disease because of the management that's traditionally been applied to them, we would have associated the main clinical signs we would have associated with squamous disease were poor appetite and unexplained weight loss. So an otherwise healthy horse that's just not eating the way it should, or is just not holding condition the way it should, primarily because it's probably not eating as much roughage as it probably should. And we'll come back to this thing about ad lib roughage versus how much they eat. You make sure you ask me about that one, because it's such a central point. So we still see that. We still see that in selected populations. But what was probably traditionally initially viewed as a high performance horse disease, racehorse disease, now we recognize much more that it's across the full spectrum of horses, it's across the full spectrum of our competition horses that we see disease. We see more glandular disease in our sports horses. When I say sports horses, I mean our warm blood show jumpers, dressage horses, these types of performance horses. They can be high level, they can be weekend warriors. They're our glandular disease poster children, our endurance horses and our race horses, our squamous disease, and there's a bit of crossover in the middle. When we get across there, it's a behavioral presentation. And that behavioral presentation is a manifestation of pain. And so we now step into, when we talked, you said, you know, it fits so nicely in the themes you've had this week. You've talked about lameness. A lot of these things that, these behavioral traits that horses, resistance, aversive behavior, undesirable behavior, a lot of these that traditionally would have been, oh, the horse has got ulcers because it's behaving badly. First of all, we've stopped using the term behaving badly. It's undesirable behavior, not bad behavior. And second of all, we now recognize that as pain-based behavior. And the really critical thing there is that's where, back to your question, what are the clinical signs that tell us about ulcers? There isn't. Those clinical signs, we recognize them as the horse's language of pain and discomfort, but it is not specific to the body system from which that pain or discomfort comes from. It's best documented in the musculoskeletal system by the enormous body of work that Sue Dyson did. It's been documented for gastric disease and it's been documented for dental disease. But it's really a recognition now that the horses have been talking to us all this time. We just haven't been listening very well. And what we need to do is take a step back. And when we see that behavior, is A, recognize it, and B, listen to it as communication of pain, and then ask, why does the horse have pain, not does the horse have ulcers? So exactly, I guess the first thing I'll say as the ulcer guy is, it's not always ulcers, and actually very often you probably need to start with a musculoskeletal exam as much as you need to start with a gastric exam.
Absolutely. Well, I think you've very eloquently explained that, just how complicated this is, because it is, you know, quite often I'm guessing the primary problem will be, say, the horse is lame, it's got a, as you say, musculoskeletal issue, and they've almost developed the ulcers as a secondary problem to that. And it may well be that you treat the lameness, you fix that problem, and then you're still seeing the signs of the ulcers after that. So it is, as you say, it might not be your first consideration, but actually it's worth investigating if your horse is showing those signs of pain.
Yeah, and this is such a new conversation. I mean, we're really talking post-COVID, this conversation, this really exploded onto the scene, led by Sue Dyson with that enormous body of work she did with the Ridden Horse Pain Ethogram, that made us all sit back and rethink, maybe we've been missing the point here. And I think, you know, honestly, we were. We live, we learn, and we move forward, and we adjust what we do. And so it's now looking at these horses saying, okay, this is pain-based behavior. And it doesn't have to just be from one cause. It doesn't have to be, the pain doesn't just have to be a sore leg or just have to be a sore back or just have to be poor bridle fit or just have to be gastric ulcers. There's an intersection between all of those potentially. We don't have good data to show that intersection between lameness and the development of glandular gastric disease. What we do have is data showing that, not, it's not published yet, but it's a large data set out of the UK by a fantastic group of researchers there, showing that horses with musculoskeletal disease, i.e. lameness or back pain, were less likely to respond to pharmacological treatment for glandular gastric disease. So there is such a strong driver of disease coming from those pain-based sources that it overrides the ability of the drugs to treat glandular disease successfully, or at least reduces the ability of the drug to treat glandular disease. And it really shows that intersection. And we've all got to stop looking at the one body system we're really well trained on. You know, we naturally will go to the one body system we're really well trained on. But I said earlier, if you actually bring me a horse for gastroscopy and the primary complaint is a behavioral presentation, the first thing I will do is a basic lameness exam. The second thing I'll do is palpate its back, and then I'll do its gastroscopy. And then I'll check its teeth, because all of a sudden now you have a much broader range of really common diseases that commonly affect sports horses, all of which can be driving behavior and all of which can intersect with each other.
Yeah, well, it shows sort of how you've got to have a very holistic approach to all of this. And I suppose that's generally the case. We're understanding this more and more in terms of the general health and well-being of our horses is a holistic approach, and also knowing your individual horse so that when they are showing those pain symptoms, you are able to spot them quickly and do something about them rather than letting them escalate to the point where we might get the more explosive behaviors like bucking and bolting and things like that.
Yeah, and look, we've got two ears, two eyes and one mouth, and that's probably the order we should apply them. And certainly, you know, when it comes to, as I said, we haven't been great listeners. And so recognizing that behavior, there is a traditional tendency to want to suppress that behavior. It's a training issue. The horse has been naughty. As I said earlier, we're moving away from that language, or we've moved away from that language. It's just, there's a bit of legacy there. But it is recognizing that. And I'd say to horse owners, it's, if you spend time with your horse and you're working with your horse, no one will know your horse better than you. And so if you perceive something, keep asking the question until you get an answer. Now, that can be a frustrating process, but the horse is trying to tell you something. And don't be put off by someone who wants to give you a quick fix that is suppressing the problem without actually solving the horse's problem. Stop looking at it from our perspective and start looking at it from the horse's perspective. And that's why diagnosis becomes so important. That's why it's so important that we have accurate diagnoses on these horses, so we actually know where in this quagmire we're trying to target our efforts to get the best outcome for ourselves, because it's expensive, but also for the horse, because ultimately we're talking about pain-based diseases that are a welfare condition.
Absolutely. At the end of the day, we all have to advocate for our individual horses and do the absolute best that we can for them as their owners, carers, whatever position we have in their lives. We've talked there about, you know, your process. If you are brought a horse with suspected ulcers, actually the fact that you're going to be doing that lameness workup, palpate the back, check the teeth. If you've done all of those and you are suspecting there are some ulcers in there, you mentioned the gastroscope, get my tongue around the word there. Do you want to talk maybe through about that process and then how you would go about treating the actual ulcers? And again, I guess this is going to depend a bit where in the stomach the problem is.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll signpost that there's not necessarily a black and white answer for treatment either, especially when we get to glandular disease. You know, in terms of diagnosis, so it goes back to, if we take that step back and we say, okay, our initial presentation is a racehorse or an endurance horse with a mild loss of appetite, you could argue it looks like a duck, it walks like a duck, and it quacks like a duck. It's probably got squamous disease. We can potentially treat that horse and look for a response. And if it is ulcers, it will respond very quickly and we'll be on the right track. And we don't lose too much by doing that. But 85% or more of the presentations of horses coming to clinics these days, and I think the ones that fit largely underneath your umbrella, fall into that undesirable behavior characteristic. Mm-hmm. And for those, we need to know what the disease is. There's multiple research studies showing that owners cannot predict whether horses have ulcers or not. It doesn't mean that they're saying there's not something wrong with the horse. It's just not ulcers, again, because it could be more than one thing driving that. And so that diagnosis becomes really important. And we talk about gastroscopy. So for gastroscopy, the horse is starved off food overnight. So generally it's fed till sort of 4 to 6 o'clock in the night, held off food overnight, which for most horses really just captures a lot of that natural fasting behavior where they tend not to eat overnight anyway. Make sure they don't have breakfast. They've got an empty stomach, a light sedation, and then a gastroscope, which is a long 3.5 meter camera down into the stomach, and the ability to observe the squamous mucosa and the glandular mucosa. That gives us an enormous amount of information. The first is it ulcers? Are there ulcers there? Doesn't necessarily say they're the cause of the problem, but it does confirm whether they're present or absent. And there have been plenty of horses where the owner has sworn black and blue that it's ulcers. We've agreed to go down this path. We won't do anything else. We do it and the stomach is pristine. It's like, okay, now we're going to take a step back and look at something else. And you know, that's why we end up with this more comprehensive approach. The second thing that gastroscopy tells us is the difference between squamous and glandular disease, because that is going to influence treatment, but it is also going to influence the factors that we identify in that horse's life for targeting those factors to reduce the risk of recurrence. because there's really no point treating the ulcers if we're not going to change something about that horse's management to stop them coming back. We don't cure them per se. We do to some degree cure squamous, but if you haven't changed the conditions, they'll be back in as little as 3 days, 3 days to a week. Glandular, a little bit slower to come back, but the same basic issue. So it tells us the difference between squamous and glandular. And then also in squamous, it can tell us a little bit more about the lesion distribution, can tell us a little bit more about some of these factors around roughage and that we might touch on later. When we think about, so now we've got our diagnosis, or at least we've got a diagnosis. We've got a gastric disease diagnosis. Treatment, squamous disease, the treatment is omeprazole. It is registered. It is well recognized, well studied. Effectively, what omeprazole does is it suppresses acid production in the stomach. I think it's probably best to say that it turns it down. It doesn't turn it off completely, but it turns it down significantly. And that allows a permissive healing environment for the stomach to naturally heal. And like we said, the squamous is like our skin. It can actually heal really well if you take away the insult. The glandular is more complex, and there is a little bit more of a less clear pathway as to what's the best treatment option. And I think the answer is there's not one clearly defined best treatment option, but we still have the option of omeprazole, but we'll combine it with another drug called sucralfate, which is a coating agent to effectively form a band-aid. And we also look at another drug called misoprostol, which works via a different pathway, stimulating mucus and blood flow and healing. And which one of those is best is really an individual decision for the vet, the horse, and the owner and that particular environment to go through. Overall, there's not necessarily a huge difference between the options, so it really comes down to that engagement with your veterinarian and applying their experience as well as, you know, what you've learned from that gastroscopy.
And do you find that some horses react better to the drugs, or some of them are more sort of resistant, or the ulcers are more resistant, or does this again come back to not fixing maybe the management problems or the exercise problems or stress-related problems, or all of those kind of things that caused the ulcers in the first place?
Yeah, so squamous disease, if we get good acid suppression, we get excellent healing. And so those lesions will heal if you get good acid suppression. And what varies from horse to horse is how well they respond to the drug in terms of acid suppression. So there's a huge variation, about an eightfold difference between individual horses as to how much drug they absorb. And that variation translates to how much acid suppression they get, or specifically it actually is how long each day they get of acid suppression, and that's the determinant factor for healing. So horses that are getting really good acid suppression will heal squamous. Horses that get less don't heal as well, or don't heal at all. Nearly all of them will improve to some degree, but it's about a 75% healing overall. The other 25 will typically improve, but not necessarily completely heal with the treatment regimen. Glandular is a very different beast. I think it's probably worth pointing out, we talk about glandular as a singular disease. Those of us that work in the area recognize it's probably not. It's probably a number of different diseases that all habitat the same part of the stomach. Same way in humans, there's about 20 different types of gastric ulcers in humans, but we just call them gastric ulcers. And there's several different causes, you know, there's several dominant causes and a bunch of uncommon causes. So we recognize that's probably the case for glandular disease. We certainly see polyps and growths that can be chronic lesions in the glandular mucosa, but we can't unpack it much more than that because we just haven't had the research opportunities to do that. And so really for glandular disease, it's sort of a lollipop approach. It's a suck and see. You have to treat and see what happens. And then, you know, the other challenge with glandular disease is it's pretty easy to say when squamous disease is healed because you can look at it and it looks normal. The glandular mucosa is a little bit more tricky in the fact that it'll sort of only show you what it wants to show you. And it can look normal but still have quite a lot of inflammation, quite a significant gastritis. So defining healing for glandular is a lot harder. And I tend to think more about squamous. I'm going to treat squamous. I'm going to try and get rid of it. And then I'm going to put these prevention strategies in to stop it coming back. Glandular, I tend to think personally more about suppressing it, making it go quiet, and then continuing it that way. And that's where that 80% horse factor comes in. It's a horse level event. And so once that horse has had those experiences or had that experience of glandular gastric disease, I tend to consider that horse, predisposed or requiring ongoing management. We don't have great long-term data, but that's certainly my clinical impression.
Now, I want to touch on the behaviour side of things, because I know this is a real sort of passion area for you, is how the behavioural impact on horses when they've had ulcers, because if I've understood the papers that right, you will be seeing, even if the actual symptoms have been resolved, those horses may well still see, you may well see those undesirable behaviors we've discussed in the horse, whether that's things like being, you know, girthy when they're tacked up, or maybe a resistance to being ridden.
Yeah, it's fantastic. And this opens a really uncomfortable conversation. It's really fascinating having this conversation. I have the privilege of speaking around the world to veterinarians. I stand up and we have these conversations, and you can sort of see a few uncomfortable expressions of people. And I've talked to some of my friends about this and gone, oh, geez, we missed the point a few times here. We've always looked at this our way, and we've said, okay, you've got ulcers, we've treated you, you're better. What's the problem? We don't understand why you're still not happy about this. And I'll tell you a story about one of our horses. We had a horse called George, and George was an off-the-track thoroughbred. He was the most kind, honest, decent horse you could ever hope to own. He took our three kids through from, junior level eventing through to, 60, 80 centimetres. Just, I think we had him 10 years. I don't think he refused to jump once in his life. Just Mr. Reliable. When we first got George, we would put the saddle on him, and as we'd do up the girth, he'd turn around and bite you. And so what did we do as what we had been trained to do? We would push George away and say, stop that, George, stop that, George, stop that, George. And we'd looked at George, and we knew he didn't have ulcers and didn't really think he had any lameness problems or anything like that. And we actually said, he's just learnt that from when he had ulcers as a racehorse. So we had that level of recognition, but we never stopped to think about it from George's point of view. What George was trying to tell us every single time he turned around to bite us, the most honest, kind, decent horse in the world, was trying to tell us, please don't hurt me. I know what you're going to do is hurt. And it's not necessarily that putting the saddle on was going to hurt, but they form a complex anticipatory association with the activity that's going to happen. And so they are smart enough to know that the saddling up means they're going to be ridden, and then that riding is going to be uncomfortable. They can bring that forward all the way through to the horse that doesn't want to be caught all of a sudden, because it knows that getting caught means it's going to get ridden, which means it's going to hurt maybe an hour later. And I really felt bad about George when I look back on this. And ultimately what happened with George was, as my kids grew up, my kids grew up and my girls became teenagers, they started doing what teenage girls do. They started loving on George. They started giving him scratches before exercise. They started feeding him before exercise. And he was like a hippopotamus. And guess what George did? He stopped the behavior, because he no longer associated what we were doing with an anticipation of pain and fear. He associated it with, hey, this is fine. I like doing this. I don't mind popping kids around. I can do this all day, every day. And that's a really uncomfortable conversation to have with yourself when you look back and you realize that, oh, wow, I got that so wrong to such a kind horse. But that's how we learn and we move forward. So I think it's recognizing they can have complex learnt behavior, and just treating the disease or diseases is sometimes not enough. We also have to look at the aspects of behavioral management to retrain them out of this. And the one thing I would say is, if this is fear-based behavior, you can't scare a horse into not being scared. So, negative reinforcement training doesn't work for these horses. I mean, you can suppress them, but you can't make something that's scared not scared by scaring it.
Yeah, it doesn't work that way, unfortunately.
No, it's all logic, about logic falls apart pretty quickly when you say it like that. But unfortunately, it's so common. And we've all been there. This is without judgment, because this is, we know what we know when we know it. But as we learn, we change, hopefully.
Yeah, as you say, it's quite an uncomfortable feeling, because you can look at that and I'm sure we've all done it, even if it is just a reactionary thing of the horse turning around to bite you and you push them away. But we have to think about it from their point of view. And as you say, if you've been doing an activity that for, however long, because a lot of the time, obviously, these ulcers or underlying problems or whatever will be you know, festering away before they get diagnosed. If you've had, say, several months of something going, ouch, yeah, I can't really blame you for not wanting to do that activity, even if the thing that caused the ouch actually has fixed, because you're still going to brace for impact.
If a horse can learn to do a leg yield, you know, to mild pressure, even without a spur, because that's an association that when I do this, I get release, it's going to learn that my stomach hurts when you put a saddle on me. And so that's why things like acupuncture points and acupressure points don't actually work very well for diagnosis, because they're not specifically targeting that response. They're targeting just, it goes back to this general pain response. They might be horses that are in generalized pain that have increased reactivity, but they're not predictive of an individual disease. I mean, sorry, gastric disease. I don't know enough about musculoskeletal disease to comment on that, but I certainly have looked at that in gastric disease and not been able to demonstrate associations.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, as you say, the logic is there that it would, again, we come back to this holistic approach and this holistic idea that pain somewhere is going to evoke a reaction, even if it's not the area we think it is. So let's come, we've sort of mentioned it throughout here, but let's come back to actually the steps we can do to, particularly with the management, how we can protect our horses from developing these ulcers, or as we say, if we've been treated, preventing them from coming back. And I will remind you at this point that you told me to remind you about the how much versus ad lib for your forage or your roughage.
Yeah, so I said earlier, I said we can make it as simple as we want or as complex as we want. And so we went through this phase when the disease was new, that all of this got information, got learned, and it was just flooding. And then, you know, you'd have lists this long, 20 different things. If your horse does this, if it's lost its car keys, if it can't, you know, read the instructions, if it can't remember its dressage test, it must have ulcers. It got a bit too complex. You know, there was everything causes ulcers without breaking it down to those, you know, really important things. And then it got a little bit too simple. It got to say, well, what you need to do is just make sure they've got hay or grass, and don't feed them any carbs, and then they'll be fine. And yet we still have pretty much the same percentage of our performance horses in some populations. I think other populations are changing. In some of our performance populations, in the US is where we've got most of our data out, the percentage of horses with gastric disease in the US population now is not dissimilar to what it was 25 years ago. And I think that comes down to, one, resistance to change within the industry for management reasons. Two, people who have tried to do the right thing, but we've been missing a point. And that point is, we said, okay, give them free choice hay. Give them as much hay as they want. But hay only works if it's inside the stomach, protecting the stomach. And I learned this one day. I went down the racetrack. I was doing a project where I was scoping horses and I had follow-up horses. And I got to my last five horses for follow-up gastroscopy, and they all had hay nets in front of them. And they should have obviously been off food overnight. And these were big 10-kilo alfalfa lucerne hay nets. Beautiful hay, beautiful quality hay. And I thought, you know what, I'll scope the first horse and just see what's in there. Maybe I can see the top half of the stomach. There was not a blade of grass in this horse's stomach. Scope the next one, three, four, five, not a single blade of hay in any of these horses' stomachs. And I'm standing there looking at them going, I would eat that hay for breakfast. And I'm not a big veggie eater. What's going on here? And I turned to the trainer, I asked him, I said, how often do you need to replace those hay nets? And he said, oh, about twice a week. So these horses, instead of eating their 10 kilograms a day, were eating 10 kilograms every 4 days, and it wasn't protecting their stomach. And that starts to close that loop back on recognition that eating is a really complex behavior for horses. So racehorses voluntarily decrease their intake for a number of factors, but eating is a really complex behavior. We know that horses that are outside spend 50% more time grazing than horses that are inside. We know that horses that are alone, horses that are cohabitating spend 40% more time grazing than horses that are alone. So then why are we surprised that horses that are in a stable by themselves get ulcers, even if they have hay? And so it comes back to recognizing that it's not just about offering them hay, it's about ensuring that they're eating it and the behavioral implications of that. And the first thing to do is measure it. the first thing is to do is measure it, and we're looking at around about 2% body weight per day as fed minimum for dry hay. If we go to silage or something like that, it's much higher. And what you suddenly realize is an awful lot of horses just don't eat that much. And so then it becomes a behavioral discussion around optimizing other factors in their environment so that they feel safe and secure enough to actually increase their hay intake. Of course, we have people who still restrict hay intake, and that's very problematic. There's been a huge push out of the UK that's been absolutely fantastic, recognizing all the challenges faced by horses with metabolic disease, but also recognizing that starving those horses is not okay from a welfare perspective. So looking at low calorie roughage like straw, and really it comes down to amount. You need 2% body weight per day, and it needs to be hay that these horses are chewing. And that's really where we start our conversation. And that's why just having the hay there is not enough. The horse has to be consuming it.
Yeah, as you say, particularly if you've got a horse that has, as you say, weight issues and things, that spreading out the hay is quite difficult. And also, obviously, if you've got horses stabled at night and you can only put your hay in first, you know, say 6 o'clock when you're bringing them in, and they've got to last until 8 o'clock the next morning when you're turning them out. So there is a real conversation around how we can spread that portion as long as it lasts as long as possible, so you haven't got these periods with nothing in there for them to eat. If you've got horses, the opposite to your race horses, they're the ones that will pig out essentially, and as soon as you get in that forage, it's gone in an hour. So yeah, it's a real tricky one. I mean, if people listen to this and they want some strategies about this, we did discuss this earlier in the week in our nutrition podcast with our nutrition dream team of Margaret Mars from Dodson & Horrell and Kate Hoare from NAF. They talked a lot about forage strategies and how you can make your forage last as long as possible. Because isn't there also a thing, Ben, where you're supposed to be feeding some sort of forage or chop fiber or something before you exercise your horse to help reduce the risk of the acid splashing up into that squamous area of the stomach?
Yeah, absolutely. And so that's the timing factor. And just before we get there, I think the other thing about forage, talking about those horses that consume everything, it's a step back from that, rethinking what's the definition of good forage for horses. And for me, from a gastrointestinal health point of view, good forage for a horse is a nutritionally suitable forage that the horse can eat as much of it as it wants while maintaining an appropriate body condition. For a horse with a very high intake, that might mean a really low nutritional quality hay or blended with straw. And there's, as I said, there's been some fantastic work out of the UK looking at that, reducing calorie content in diet. And interestingly, when you blend straw in, it doesn't just reduce calorie diet, it reduces voluntary intake while maintaining chew cycles, which is where the saliva comes from, and without the development of gastric disease. So there are ways of doing it, but we can't go and buy that dairy cow hay and then restrict it. And we also have we're just scratching the surface, but yes, we use extension strategies, but they may actually carry risk of disease. So we have one study from Denmark where we haven't published the data yet, but basically we looked at horses had hay, and they either had loose hay or in a hay net, but this is just a standard hay net, not like a slow feeder. Horses that were consuming the hay loose consumed 50% more hay voluntarily and had a reduced risk of squamous disease. And so there are strategies for reducing or prolonging roughage, but I would argue from a gastric point of view, they're not without cost. It gets quite complex. And that's where looking at an individual horse and following that horse over time is so important, because what will work for one won't necessarily work for another. Back to your question about timing, absolutely. So the other factor is making sure that normal protective mechanism for the horse's stomach is effectively a ball of food inside that horse's stomach. I think of it like a basketball of food inside that horse's stomach. And what we want is that inside the stomach when the horse exercises, because what that does is it literally physically holds the acid down in the bottom half of the stomach and stops it splashing up onto the top half of the stomach. And so horses naturally during the day, they've got access to roughage, will eat 70-80% of their roughage intake during the day. And so, you know, ideally we exercise them in the afternoon when they've had access to roughage during the day and restored that natural ball. we know that if we exercise them first thing in the morning, where they typically have fasted overnight because that's when they sleep, they're going to have an empty stomach. And that's a very high risk period for exercising because the acid is going to just splash around up onto the squamous mucosa. And that's quite classic of what we'd sort of talk about, a thoroughbred racehorse stomach, where they work early in the morning without food in their stomachs and it splashes up. So that timing is really important. But from a management strategy point of view, we can do that as part of our management pre-ride. Bring the horse up, offer it alfalfa, lucerne, hay. I prefer long stem hay because long stem hay requires more chewing than chaff or pellets. And so we know that horses with long stem hay chew about four times as much as horses with pellets. Every time we chew, we make saliva. Saliva is the natural buffer. And I'll feed it from ground level, not from a hay net where possible, because interestingly, fed the same hay, horses chew twice as much when it's down at ground level than they do at shoulder height. And so we can do that as a really effective way of optimizing the defense mechanisms before exercise. And that can be particularly important if the horse has been out in grass, because grass doesn't necessarily form that ball very well. Because if you think of grass, it can be quite slushy. So reinforcement. And then the kicker is, back to our conversation before, is that's also a very strong behavioral motivator for most horses. And it's a very, all of a sudden we're doing a positive reinforcement tool without thinking that we're doing positive reinforcement. Positive reinforcement doesn't have to be super complicated. It really can be as simple as food and a scratch. I'm not saying that we want to, I'm not taking away from the people who do it really well, but what I'm saying is, as the average horse person, we can start with some pre-exercise feeding and a scratch. The horse that has that has got optimized gastric defense mechanisms and is in a better mood, feeling better before it goes out to train. Surely that's a better place to be.
And stress is going to be another factor, isn't it? Again, we've talked about, particularly maybe more with the glandular side, the impact stress might have on a horse in terms of predisposing them to ulcers. That's also going to have to factor into how we're managing them as well, isn't it?
Yeah, huge driver of glandular disease. Also, I think an under-recognized driver of squamous disease, because a horse that's not stressed won't eat. You know, we talked before already about horses that are cohabitate, they spend more time grazing. Horses that are turned out, they spend more time grazing. And all of a sudden, we're talking about the three Fs: friends, forage, and freedom. And I think, I know that that's, I think, tomorrow's talk. And I think that's a great place to end, because it closes the loop on, we can talk about gastric disease as much as we want, but what I think is becoming increasingly obvious to me is gastric disease is also a really good reflection of the horse's overall well-being, because it's very, very hard to get good gastric health if you don't have excellent well-being for those horses. And what I'd encourage people to do is, if they see gastric disease in their horse, it's the same thing as seeing those behavioral changes. Yes, we're going to want to treat it, but that should be our signpost to ask the question, what is driving this in this individual horse under its conditions that I can hopefully address, not just to make the disease go away so I don't have to buy more drugs because it's expensive, but because I want to improve my horse's welfare and well-being and quality of life. And so we know things like, we talked about exercise days, we know that things like increasing number of handlers and riders can be stressful for horses and can increase the risk of glandular disease. I suspect that varies dramatically from horse to horse and type of horse to type of horse. We know that some horse breeds are far more emotionally expressive than others, and so they're going to be more influenced by those type of things. It's also going to be personality based. Some horses are just everyone's friend and some horses are ride or die for one person. But we know their factors. We know those pain-based factors are really important. And then we don't have great data on the three Fs for glandular disease, but that's largely because I don't think we've had the opportunity to study populations where we've actually had the distinct groups to compare. We tend to look at fairly homogenous groups and then we don't see a difference, but I don't think that means the effect is not there. The other thing I think that's really important is it increases their risk of disease, but it also means that if they do have disease or low-grade disease, I think it reduces their tolerance of disease and they're more likely to feel the impact of disease and they're more likely to express the impact of that disease than if their overall well-being is excellent.
Absolutely. It's sort of, again, we come back to the word holistic. It all ties in together. And as you say, our topic for tomorrow is very much focusing on the other 23 hours of a horse's day, which includes those three Fs and also the five domains as well, and how giving our horses an environment that is set up to support them and support their natural needs will have positive impact across the board in the 24th hour as well, when we are actually riding them or training them. So do tune into that one as well, because it is a really interesting discussion. A lot of the things you've discussed there, and you know, we've talked about across this episode, when it comes to our competition horses, who you said have, we see far more prevalence of ulcers, a lot of the fighters we've talked about are not really compatible with how we tend to keep our competition horses, our race horses. Are ulcers just kind of something we have to kind of accept, I guess, in some cases? Is it a sort of part and parcel with having our horses in sport?
Yeah, so we can be, you know, you tend to get into these absolutist discussions, and this is potentially one of those. The other one is non-structural carbohydrates. You know, we said as a risk factor for squamous disease. I think of them like red wine, like a little bit of non-structural carbohydrates, like me drinking a glass of red wine every day. It's fine. If I drink two bottles a day, it's not good. And you know, for horses, that's around about a gram per kilogram per meal of non-structural carbohydrate. That's a lot. The vast majority of our competition horses shouldn't be eating anywhere near that carbohydrate. So we've got to be careful of these absolutist discussions. We've got to recognize that horses can adapt to these environments. We've got to recognize there's individual differences, but we also have to, as I said, when we see that horse with gastric disease, ask ourselves, is this a signpost that there's something that can be changed? And so the question, is this just a necessary price we pay because of behavioral impacts on hay, which I'd argue we should be addressing for well-being long before we address it for gastric disease, non-structural carbohydrates, exercise. We have our competition horses. We have about 8 to 10 competition horses at any given time that my kids ride and I used to ride. And we will travel every second or third weekend. And when I say travel, we travel 6 to 8 hours in each direction. So we haul out pretty significantly. And I had the opportunity, I scoped my horses at the end of our competition season, which runs from March through to November. I scoped my horses at the end of the competition season just to see where everyone sat. And despite the fact that our horses work hard in the context of management, not a single horse had squamous disease. Okay, I went back, I scoped them halfway through the competition season next year. Not a single horse had squamous disease, and none of these horses are receiving medications. They're receiving management, and some of the horses are receiving targeted supplements. So that's pretty good. You know, we run 2 foot up to 1 star, but you know, we're not the real deal. That's not the way it works in the real world. And then I had the opportunity to scope the competition string of one of our Olympic show eventers. And so we're now talking horses that are 3 pushing 4 star level midway through the season. Not a single one of their horses had squamous disease. And so this is a population that we would look at and say, these horses must have ulcers because they're ticking all of these boxes. But when you took a step back, those horses had outstanding well-being. They were managed with friends, forage, freedom, and all of those things done right. And there were no squamous disease in those horses. So I refute the idea that, especially in our competition horses, that it's a necessary price that we have to pay. I strongly refute that because we're not the ones paying the price. The horse is the one paying the price. And so, again, I would encourage people that when you see that, it should be the drive to go back and find a reason why and try and change something, because we should be able to manage it out of our competition horse populations. Race horses are inherently challenging because of the nature of their work and the timing of their work. And that's a structural level challenge at the industry. But that's also why we see a much more widespread adoption of preventative dosing of omeprazole, in recognition that there's only so much we can do for management to prevent disease. I would still argue all of that management's critical for well-being for those horses. But from a gastric point of view, we're less able to impact that than we should be able to impact a competition horse population.
As you say, it's just kind of a case of going back to your basics, paying attention to your horses. And ultimately, at the end of the day, if we want our horses to perform at the top level, having them in the optimum condition, not having any pain, not having any resistance to the work they're doing is only going to be a winner. So as you say, it all kind of makes sense. It's just having that willingness to rethink maybe the things we do and pay attention to what the horses are telling us at the end of the day.
Yeah, take a step back, rethink it, and try to look at it from the horse's perspective, not ours, and have a really uncomfortable conversation with yourself. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of these things, and people get really super defensive about this, because we're challenging things that are just hardwired in the way that people are taught to handle horses or taught to raise horses or taught you need to do this to get a good competition horse. And that just simply isn't true. I'm an absolute fanboy of Jessica von Bredow. I'm not necessarily a big fanboy of dressage, but her management of her horses, her commitment to the three F's for her well-being of her horses that then for her translates to performance is fantastic. And FEI are doing a great series with her at the moment. She's done some private social media stuff. And I always hold her out as an example. If it's good enough for an Olympic dressage gold medalist to do this, it is good enough for any of us. And I guarantee you, she was taught as hardline as anyone as the way horses are meant to be raised, but she's had that absolute maturity to step back and that piece of vision of mind to step back and go, but what about the horse? And I think that's where we really have to come back to, is keep asking, what about the horse? What's the horse think of this?
Absolutely. Putting the horse front and foremost when it comes to making those decisions. We've talked about quite a lot of different stuff today, and it has been an absolutely fascinating conversation. But if you had to pick one sort of key takeaway for people to have in the back of their head after listening to this episode, what would it be?
I'm going to give you two because I can't talk that short. One is listen. We've got to be better listening. The horses are trying to tell us something with their behavior. We have to be better listening to understanding that as the horse's language of pain. And then we have to work collaboratively as horse owner, horse caregivers, to understand those sources of pain, treat the horses of pain, sources of pain, and prevent them from coming back. If I go back into my own little wheelhouse a little bit and stay where I probably should stay the whole time, which is talk about gastric ulcers, I really think the idea that the stomach is a reflection of the horse's well-being would be a really valuable take-home message. It is very hard to get good gastric health without good well-being, and we can use that as the horse's mirror to tell us a window into its well-being by looking at its stomach.
Absolutely. There we go, people. Look at your horse's stomach. It is the mirror to their soul. I really like that as a metaphor, because I think it, as everything we've discussed today, feeds exactly into that message. It's, you know, everything plays into what we're seeing on the outside. So no, absolutely. I think that's a really great takeaway for people.
And maybe the third one is, don't just treat the stomach, treat the horse.
Yeah, there we go. Treat the horse, people. Now, you shared with me, Ben, a really great video series, which I will put the links to on our digital hub, where all the resources that we've shared across Equine Health Week will be. You can find that at www.britishequestrian.org.uk. There will be a banner at the top of the page, or you can go to the Equine tab and find it through that. So the links will be there. But do you have any other sort of resources for people who maybe want to find out a bit more about what we've discussed today?
Look, I think that's a great place to start. I think you're exceptionally blessed in the UK that you have got a group of equine veterinarians who are world leaders in the gastric ulcer space. The UK has taken an enormously strong leadership position from a research perspective, from a clinical perspective. So I think you've got, you know, the resources there. Use them, listen to them. We're working in the background to update the sort of the international reference document for veterinarians that we published 10 years ago and is due for an update. And so watch that space. It'll come out. And when it does, we'll sort of be trying to promote that heavily, covering this full range of stuff we've talked about and then some, I guess.
Perfect. And I guess as well, one of our sort of overriding themes from across this week is to have the relationship and the dialogue with your vet, because they are going to really help you if your horse has got any health problems, whether they are gastric or the, say, the lameness ones and back problems and teeth problems that we have discussed that could well be related or a precursor to those gastric problems that we've talked about today. Thank you ever so much, Ben, for giving up your time to speak to us today. It's been, as I said already, a really, really interesting conversation, and I really hope that everyone listening has got some bits, whether it is that key takeaway message or just far more everything else we've talked about. Hopefully they can take that away into how they are looking after their own horses. So thank you very much.
Thanks for having me, Rachel, and thank you everyone for joining in. Happy trails, happy riding, happy dressage, happy jumping. We all enjoy our contact with them for different reasons. So thank you for just putting this together for everyone.
Absolutely, no problem at all. It's been, personally, I've thoroughly enjoyed it, so I can't really complain. If it's just me, I've learned a lot today, so that is good. But to those of you listening along at home, thank you so much for joining us. Make sure that you have caught up with everything we've discussed so far for Equine Health Week. You can find the whole podcast series wherever it is that you found this one, and all the resources and the podcast episodes as well will be on that digital hub that I've already discussed. So make sure you check that out and follow our social media as well, because there's loads of really great resources across a whole range of topics, and we've spoken to some brilliant experts this week. We hope you'll join us for the final day of Equine Health Week tomorrow, where we will be discussing, amongst other things, the three F's that we've discussed several times today. So do join us then. We hope to see you soon, and thank you very much for listening.